from the end of your Bible. And this will be one of my shortest series ever. Two messages to get through a book. You know, we've been galloping through Galatians and flying through Philippians, and then we did Philemon, and we've started, we're just going to be continuing to work our way through New Testament books, and we'll do some Old Testament books. One of the objectives here is I want for us to have a picture of what entire books mean. And then when we finish that, we can start all over again. And that, so we'll just keep working our way through and coming to understand the text. The objective is to be able to understand how it goes together. It's very easy to come away with a picture of, I know this doctrine or I know that doctrine, but where does it come from? How do we know what we know, and how can we explain it to someone without having to jump to 10 different places? It's important for us to be able to understand what the text means in its own context for our own understanding, for our own Bible reading, and to be able to explain to others. Let's review what we have covered thus far in 3 John. We have a prayer in verses 2 through 4 in which John prays for Gaius to prosper as his soul prospers. If his life is not very prosperous in the Lord, that's not a very optimistic prayer, would it be? If he has a rotten walk with the Lord, this would be a curse. This would not be a blessing that he would be praying. Gaius has given great testimony in his life. And so John is aware of this. So he prays for him to prosper as his soul prospers. And the reason for that is because John's emissaries have reported that Gaius walks in truth. And that is something that gives John great pleasure. Notice as we look in verse 3, for I rejoiced greatly when brethren came and testified of the truth that is in you, just as you walk in truth. There were people who came back to John and told him about Gaius. Now, we receive a little bit more information about that in verse 5. When he says, beloved, you do faithfully whatever you do for the brethren and for strangers. We saw that these strangers are believers. The way that we see that is because verse 6, who, and the who refers back to brethren as well as strangers, have borne witness of your love before the church. He obviously wouldn't be asking for unbelievers to give testimony before the church. But this is telling us something about who the brethren are. They are people that John knows, whereas the strangers would be people that Gaius did not know, but John has sent them. That helps us to understand verse 3 a little better. I rejoiced greatly when brethren came. Well, the brethren that came and talked to John were emissaries that he had sent out. He had sent people out, and then they came back and they have a report. John is probably down south, probably in Jerusalem area, and the letter is probably being written up to, or being sent up into Asia Minor. So, brethren have testified, those that have been traveling, about the truth that is in Gaius. Just as Gaius walks in truth. I'll put this a little lower. Okay. So John is saying in verse 3 that he rejoiced greatly when brethren came and testified of the truth that is in him, just as he walks in the truth. We observe that this walking in the truth is parallel to what John had said in 1 John chapter 1 about walking in the light. He's talking about a man who is walking, having fellowship with God and having fellowship with his fellow believers who are also walking in the light. And these people, these emissaries that are also walking in truth, have reported to John that Gaius walks in truth. In verse 4, John says that he has no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. He is wanting for believers to have fellowship with the Lord and fellowship with other believers who are having fellowship with the Lord. So that's verses 2 through 4. John prays for Gaius to prosper, and the reason that he has a prayer for him to prosper just as his soul prospers is because of the reports that he has gotten back about Gaius walking in the truth. Then verses 5 through 8 is looking at Gaius and talking a little bit more about specifically what it is that John saw that was evidence that he was walking in the truth. He says in verse 5, "Beloved, you do faithfully whatever you do for the brethren and for strangers who have borne witness of your love before the church. If you send them forward on their journey in a manner worthy of God, you will do well, because they went forth for his name's sake, taking nothing from the Gentiles. We therefore ought to receive such that we may become fellow workers for the truth." John is saying that Gaius is faithful to believers that he knows as well as to believers that he does not know. So therefore, for him to continue receiving people who minister in Christ's name that refuse support from the Gentile unbelievers will make Gaius their fellow worker, sharing in their reward. We saw from the gospel picture here is being able to join with and to receive part of the reward. So, John is looking at Gaius and saying that he has been faithful in ministering to these traveling ministers, and they are ministers who are ministering in the name of the Lord, and they are not receiving support from the Gentiles, specifically Gentile unbelievers. They are focused upon the Lord's ministry and raising the funds properly, that is, in the Lord's way. And because they are properly focused, entering into their ministry by contributing, by helping, by being hospitable, is a way for Gaius to enter into their reward as well. So far, everything looks fine. And we can say that Gaius himself has a walk with the Lord that is commendable. John gives evidence of that because of what he has said. But on the horizon, there are also people within this congregation that John is writing to that are having some real problems, some major difficulties. And so tonight we are going to be looking at the person who is the center of the problem. His name is Diotrephes. And then we're going to take a look at one of John's emissaries, Demetrius. So this passage is Diotrephes and Demetrius. In verse 9, John says, "I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them, does not receive us. Therefore, if I come, I will call to mind his deeds which he does, prating against us with malicious words. And not content with that, he himself does not receive the brethren, and forbids those who wish to, putting them out of the church. Beloved, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. He who does good is of God, but he who does evil has not seen God. Demetrius has a good testimony from all and from the truth itself. And we also bear witness, and you know that our testimony is true." In looking at John speaking in verse 9 about having written to Diotrephes, but Diotrephes doesn't receive them, and he has his own set of problems, we're going to need to look at that a little more closely. My outline point here is John wrote to the church, but Diotrephes does not receive the apostles or their emissaries because he seeks preeminence among the elders. You may have noticed, if you looked at the notes, we're going to, at the very end of this message, talk about the plurality of elders within churches. So we're going to be tying that together just a little more. But specifically, within the leadership, Diotrephes wanted to rise up into preeminence. He wanted to be the number one person there and run the whole show. And that just simply is not the way that God operates things in the New Testament. Notice, John says he wrote to the church, but Diotrephes does not receive us. Now, we might think, as we read this, well, John may have written to him months ago, but he hasn't got an answer. But let's back away from our 21st century set of presuppositions. How was it that John would have had that letter delivered? Did it go through the U.S. Postal Service? Not likely. Whenever we see books in the New Testament and we start looking very closely at the names of the people within it, it's very common for the author to identify the person who was carrying the letter. Remember, we talked about there was a constant back and forth between the apostles and the various congregations. And so what happened was an apostle would communicate truth that would be carried by someone that he had sent specifically to deal with certain issues, to be pastorally involved with the congregation, to be able to give a report of what was going on with the apostles, and then to take a message back, go back and report to the apostle. And there was a constant staying in touch with various congregations. But what John is speaking of here is when he has sent a messenger with a letter for Diotrephes, Diotrephes said, not interested, goodbye, take off, see you later. And he may have sent, right now, as he's sending the letter to Gaius, he may have sent a letter at the same time with Demetrius to Diotrephes. But he is expecting for that letter to be not received. So he wrote something to the church, but he is not expecting Diotrephes to be able to deliver it successfully. He does not receive us. He doesn't receive our emissaries. He doesn't receive the letters that we have. He does not have fellowship with the apostles. This is a major problem. And yet, when we ask ourselves the question, does Diotrephes have false doctrine? There is no evidence within this book whatsoever that he was teaching a false message. Because wouldn't John's number one concern be with his false teaching if he were teaching false information? The problem with Diotrephes does not seem to be that he is into heresy as far as his doctrines. He could sign an orthodox doctrinal statement. He could sign it and everyone would say, wow, this is just fine. But he wanted to rise to preeminence. He wanted to be above the elders within his congregation, and he wanted to be even above the apostles. That's where his problem is coming in. This is a man who is being driven by wanting to be first, by being in power. And John is going to be addressing Diotrephes when he comes because of the problems that Diotrephes has with pride, of wanting to be first, about trying to run the whole show. So John says that he wrote to the church, but Diotrephes does not receive us, and therefore does not receive our letters, our communications. think back to the book of 1 John. In fact, let's turn back to 1 John chapter 1. In 1 John 1, 3, John says, "That which we have seen," which, as we explained before, is concerning the word of life, the end of verse 1. We've explained that in an earlier message. "That concerning the message of life, which we have seen and heard, we declare to you for the purpose that you may have fellowship with us, and truly our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ." This purpose was not accomplished in a man like Diotrephes, because Diotrephes had no fellowship with the apostles, and he had no fellowship with the Lord either. The fellowship that John is talking about in 1 John is a vertical and a horizontal fellowship. Okay, let's go back to 3 John. Doesn't this sound similar to the situation that Paul described in Philippians chapter 1? Hey, I'm seeing blank stares. Let's go back to Philippians chapter 1. See, if we get a picture of how the New Testament goes together and we're able to see book after book after book, we will start to see the similarities in situation. The problems seem to come up over and over and over again. You could have different personalities, but the same problems come up. And the reason for the same problems is the same underlying causes. People got turned sideways and were ceasing to be focused upon the Lord and wanting to please Him. Remember, we talked in Philippians chapter 1 about Paul saying that his imprisonment has furthered the cause of the gospel. Do you remember the first way that it did that? The praetorium, many in the praetorium have come to know that Paul was imprisoned not for his guilt, but he was imprisoned for the cause of Christ. And secondly, what was the second benefit that furthered the gospel that came out of Paul's imprisonment? People became bold. Most of the brethren were emboldened to speak the word of the Lord without fear. But then as we look at verse 15, some of the believers indeed preach Christ even from envy and strife, and some also from goodwill. The former preach Christ from selfish ambition. They're wanting to rise up at Paul's expense. Say, "Oh, you know, Paul's in prison. I'm here to your rescue." You have people who are acting a lot like Diotrephes. It's not the same personalities, different people, but the same types of things are going on. Think also, what was it that Paul, in the book of Philippians, wanted the Philippian congregation to do? He wanted them to have the same mind in themselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, putting the interests of others ahead of their own. Diotrephes could take advice from the book of Philippians if Paul had been sending that to him. He wasn't sending it to Diotrephes, but he could have benefited from that same exhortation. But as we go back to 3 John, John is going to need to deal with Diotrephes, whose love of preeminence has caused him not to receive the apostles, not wanting to have fellowship with them. Verse 10 draws an inference. In light of him not receiving John or his emissaries, John will recount, and he doesn't say that the circumstances are an excommunication trial or some sort of disciplinary action, but that's where it would be occurring. John will recount Diotrephes' tattling gossip. That would be a little clearer words than our new King James has it, as they say, prating with malicious words. Prating is gossip. So he has all sorts of half-truths and outright lies and all sorts of things that he says about the apostles and probably about his emissaries, saying, you know, they shouldn't be accepted. They've got this kind of problem, that kind of problem. And he's giving all sorts of reasons for the people within that congregation to say, oh, well, I guess we really shouldn't receive those people. John would be leading us astray. But instead, he's wanting to be first. But he's not content just to gossip against them. He himself does not receive the brethren and forbids those who wish to, putting them out of the church. What he's saying here is, people who do like you, Gaius, what did Gaius do? Gaius showed hospitality both to the brethren and to strangers. He said, people who do this seem to run sideways against Diotrephes. Gaius knew this very well. Because John is not writing to Gaius about some church that's 1,000 miles away from where Gaius is. He's talking to him about his own church. He's talking to him about someone else that is there among the elders of that congregation. Gaius has seen this type of thing happen, but Gaius has been one who has continued to stand for the truth. Notice how many times truth has been associated with Gaius. Verse 1, to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth. In verse 3, these people, the brethren, came in and testified of the truth that is in you, just as you walk in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. Consistently, John is putting an emphasis upon truth. Look down at verse 8, where he speaks about those ministers who are traveling around as being workers for the truth, and these people being able to, or Gaius being able to join in as a fellow worker with them. Truth is extremely important here. Diotrephes has put his own self-interest above the interests of having fellowship with the apostles, of being fellow workers, of participating together. And as John looks at it, he's saying, Gaius, you know this guy, and I'm going to be dealing with him. He's telling him, don't worry about it. I'm coming. Now you look at that and you say, well, wait a moment. It doesn't sound all that confident that John's going to come. Look at verse 10. Therefore, if I come, I will call to mind his deeds, which he does. Now, why is it that Diotrephes can act so cavalierly? John is a long way away. John is clear down in Jerusalem, and he's way up in Asia Minor. But let's see some evidence that John expects indeed to come. Look at verses 13 and 14. I had many things to write to you, but I do not wish to write to you with pen and ink, but hope to see you shortly, and we shall speak face to face. So he said, Diotrephes had better watch out, because I'm planning a trip. I'm planning to come up here, and we're going to deal with these things in truth, and his gossiping, his prating, all this stuff is going to be exposed for what it is, an empty set of lies. All designed to keep him in power. All designed to keep him propped up. But when John comes, how long do you think Diotrephes is going to stay in power? Not long at all. His little empire is going to be dealt with. But during this period of time where Diotrephes seems to have the upper hand, he doesn't receive the brethren, and he has enough power within that congregation because he's put himself to be first, that he's able to put people out of the church. He's able to excommunicate them. He's able to get people to shun this person and not have anything more to do with them because they went against his authority. Authority he didn't really have. Authority that belonged under the control of a group of elders having fellowship with the apostles rather than by a lone gun who did not have fellowship with the apostles. As a result of this with Gaius, in relation to Diotrephes, John wants to urge Gaius to continue his stand for the truth. He has proximity with Diotrephes, and that becomes rather clear in verse 11. Beloved, do not imitate what is evil. Don't imitate Diotrephes. You know who he is. You know what he's like. Don't imitate him. Don't cave in and start following his ways, but instead imitate what is good. And then the second part of the verse is directed at Gaius himself. He who does good is of God, but he who does evil has not seen God. Gaius, if you do good, you're of God. Gaius, if you do evil, you've not seen God. It's a warning here for him and an exhortation for him to do what was commanded in verse 11 of imitating what is good. Outline point for the verse. Gaius should not imitate Diotrephes' evil, but he should imitate what is good, because the one who does good is of God, but the one who does evil has not seen God. If he wants to have fellowship, continued fellowship with the apostles and with the emissaries that have been sent, he needs to continue doing what it is that he has been doing, continuing to welcome the emissaries. At this point in time, it's really a matter of what is Gaius going to do with regard to Demetrius as Demetrius comes up to the door and hands him this letter. He has this letter in his hand, and his opportunity here is to either accept Demetrius for what he is or to turn him away, joining with Diotrephes. He has that as his choice that is set before him. Now, as we look at the last half of verse 11, the person might wonder, he who does good is of God, he who does evil has not seen God. Is that saying the person who does good is a believer and the person who does evil is an unbeliever? No, it isn't. Imagine that we were to hit the light switch. We turned off all the lights in here, pulled all the drapes, closed all the doors. Then, now with it being all closed, I say, turn in your Bibles to page 500. And will each of you please read the first sentence that appears on page 500 in your Bibles? How are we going to do? Now, if I had told you to quote a particular verse, you might be able to quote the verse out of memory, but you wouldn't be reading it. When he talks about not having seen God, we don't see God apart from seeing him through his word. If we are not walking in the light, if we are not having fellowship with God, how much do we get out of the word when we read it? When he says the person hasn't seen God, that's what he's talking about. It's like looking at a page down half a mile at the bottom of the Tower Sudan mine in Minnesota, half a mile underground. When they turn off those lights in there, it's dark. You can put your hand right here and you can't see it. You cannot see it at all. It's as if it weren't there. What he's talking about here is the person who is of God is the person who has fellowship with God. The person who has seen God is someone who has fellowship with God. And what he's talking about is walking in the light or walking in the truth. And what is being presented to Gaius is you have the opportunity right now to choose between walking in the light, walking in the truth, or walking in a lie, imitating the outer feast. The choice is rather simple. It's rather straightforward that is set before Gaius. In verse 12, then John is going to give a reason why he should receive Demetrius. Why it is that he should listen to what he has to say. And why it is that he should not turn him away as Diotrephes would undoubtedly urge him to do. Demetrius has a good testimony from all and from the truth itself. And we also bear witness, and you know that our testimony is true. Notice how this parallels what has happened with Gaius himself. Because what happened before the church concerning Gaius? There were brethren and strangers who reported to John that Gaius walks in truth. Remember that? That's back in verse 3. But likewise, Demetrius has a good testimony from all. Believers who have seen him are able to testify that he walks in the truth. He walks in the light. He has fellowship with the Father, with his Son, Jesus Christ, with the apostles, and with the brethren. But the truth itself, the Word of God, testifies that he also has a good testimony. It bears good testimony of him. And John himself also bears witness, and you know that our testimony is true. Lo and behold, we have more than three witnesses, do we not? And as Frank could tell you, John's gospel could better be called the testimony of John because of how John structures the close of his book, and he uses the word testimony and testify and witness many, many, many times within the book. This is quite in keeping with what John does. John sees this as a court trial, and we have good witnesses and we have disqualified witnesses. Gaius is a qualified witness. John is a qualified witness. Demetrius is. But Diotrephes is not. He should not be heard because look at how much lying and how much falsehood he's characterized by. He gossips, he prates against the apostles with malicious words, and he is rejecting those from whom the truth has been passed to him. So, John has written, and Demetrius is undoubtedly carrying a letter to see if perhaps Diotrephes will accept it. But John doesn't expect that he will. John is going to need to come, and he's going to need to deal with him in a trial. And so he urges Gaius to imitate what is good and not to be following Diotrephes, which would be the easy thing to do in this situation because Diotrephes seems to be the one with all the power. Well, that brings John to his conclusion, verses 13 and 14. He had much to write to Gaius, but prefers speaking over writing because he expects to travel to speak with him shortly. So verses 13 through 14a, I had many things to write, but I do not wish to write you with pen and ink. If John were not planning to come soon, he needed to write it. But since John says, I'm planning to come soon, it says, okay, I'm just going to touch the bases that you need for right now. I'll follow it up with a visit in person. I hope to see you shortly. We shall speak face to face. John is giving Gaius enough truth to help him to continue to walk in truth, to continue to walk in fellowship, to have fellowship with the apostles and with the Lord. He's giving him enough information, but he wants to meet with him, and he's planning to do so. They'll take care of the situation with Diotrephes, and Gaius will undoubtedly be poised to take a role that he does not presently have within this congregation after John deals with Diotrephes, and they get certain problems straightened out. So that leads to a farewell in verse 14b. The friends who are with John greet Gaius, and Gaius is to greet the friends personally. So he says, our friends greet you, greet the friends by name. Now, Quaker churches often refer to themselves as Friends Church. This is one of the passages from which they get that title. But there are a few things that we need to deal with here, because it's very easy for us to get the idea that a specific set of words has no overlap with other words. You may have heard that agapao love or agape love and philo or philos love have no point in contact whatsoever. I would say very strongly, John does not give evidence of differentiating sharply between those words. People have often gotten that impression from John 21, but I think that it's a misunderstanding of John 21. But we don't have time for John 21 tonight. So we'll deal with this a little more briefly. The word here for friend is philos. So you can see how it's related to the word philo, or philos, love. But notice, just for a couple of examples, in John chapter 20, verse 2, then she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom, now this is one disciple, whom Jesus loved. And this has normally been argued to be the apostle John. Notice philo is the verb that is used here. And said to them, they have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have laid him. Now look at John 13:23. Now there was, leaning on Jesus, one of his disciples whom, singular, so it's not that he loved all the disciples, it's one in particular that he loved, John, and so whom Jesus loved, and the verb here is agapao. You've heard the phrase in English, it many times is used within the book, the disciple whom Jesus loved. And John interchanges between these words. And he interchanges at many points in different types of context within the Gospel of John between these two words. John does not sharply distinguish between them. And now let's look at the evidence within this book that he doesn't sharply distinguish. Notice how he says, our friends greet you, greet the friends by name. Doesn't that imply if someone loves you, then you love them in return? So what you would say is, isn't Gaius a friend of these friends? Isn't he a philos of them? And isn't he a philos, a friend of the Apostle John? That would be an appropriate way to describe him. But let's look at what words John used to describe Gaius at the beginning of the book. The elder to the beloved agapetos, Gaius, whom I love, agapao, in truth. So notice how there's an interchange between phileo and agapao right here within this book, both being directed by John in relation to Gaius. It's very hard to distinguish these words as sharply as many people would want to differentiate them. You know, it's like this. Tonight I am going to go home in an automobile. Tomorrow night I'm going to go home in a car. Am I saying that I'm going to have two different means of transportation home? Not necessarily. Now, there might be more than one vehicle in the family, but I'm not proving that by using those two words. There's a lot of overlap between Greek words, just as there's a lot of overlap between English words. We can't make the assumption just because a different word was used that it automatically means that everything's different and we have these neat little boxes. Words have to communicate. And the rules that work in English are not all that different than the rules that work in Greek. But, you know, it's really funny. We get to religious things, we get to the Bible, and we say, oh, these words have these tight little compartments and never shall they meet. You know, it's kind of like an uncle of mine that lived in Minnesota. And he had his own plate. And he would only eat on his own plate. His plate had ridges. And it kept the potatoes from touching the meat, from touching vegetables. And he said that his food did not get mixed in his stomach. It went down in layers. Well, we kind of get that way when we think about words in the Bible. But there is overlap. We have to allow context to tell us what words mean. Now, we've talked about it here in John. This is going to be a side note. This isn't proving anything about John, but just for fun, let's go to 1 Thessalonians. It will be another illustration of the same thing going on that other authors also have flexibility for meanings. 1 Thessalonians. Chapter 4, verse 9. But concerning brotherly love, now that's a compound word in Greek, Philadelphia. And you can recognize the city of brotherly love got its name from the Greek word brotherly love. But you notice phila, so phileo or philos is part of it, of that word, right? But concerning brotherly love, you have no need that I should write to you. Why? For you yourselves are taught by God to agapao one another. Okay, if Paul says, I don't need to teach you about phileo love because you've been taught agapao love, he had better not be saying these are two completely different things that are so distinct from each other that they don't have any contact. Okay. See, we study Greek in order to be able to understand what the text means, but it's important not to parade up and to focus upon some things and treat them as though they change everything when some of those things don't change everything. We need to know what changes the meaning and what doesn't. We have to focus upon what the argument of the book says. Now, I've spoken a little bit about this because I know that from other quarters, and that we hear such things as there being impersonal love and all sorts of things like that. And there's just it's important to be able to re-examine all that. We've got to work with what does the text say. Okay, so So, going back to 3 John. John is saying that the friends who are with him, those people who are walking in the truth that have fellowship with the Father, with the Son, and with the apostles, are greeting Gaius. And Gaius is to greet other people who also have fellowship with the Father and with his Son and with the other brethren who walk in truth. Would it sound really radical if I were to propose that since fellowship is both vertical and horizontal, that the friends are people who have fellowship vertically and horizontally? The friends, or the beloved ones, are seen as people who have fellowship. Fellowship only happens as we walk in the light. Well, obviously, if we've sinned, what do we need to do in order to make it so that we are able to walk in the light? We have to confess our sins. Confession of sins doesn't equal walking in the light, though. So we confess sins, that enables us to walk in the light. As we walk in the light, as we study the Word, and as the Word changes us, we develop friendship with people and with the Lord. That's very much what he's talking about. It says it's very easy to get sideways like Diotrephes and get one's eyes upon oneself. Diotrephes was someone who didn't look out for the interests of others ahead of himself. He was someone who looked out for his own interests. Hurting a lot of people around him. Okay, there's one other excursus I'd like to take on page 3. At an earlier time, we gave a general overview of plurality of elders. And I'd like to reinforce that just a little bit. So we'll look here within 3 John just briefly, and we'll touch upon a few other passages that we've talked about at other times. Diotrephes loves to have preeminence. Does John regard that as a good thing? No. John's model of a local church did not include the idea of a pastor who was preeminent, who called the shots, and everyone, all the elders, all the deacons, everybody else was under his rules, but he was under his own rules. That's something that John is very concerned about here. Preeminence among the leadership is not a good thing. That is not what John is aiming at. John is aiming at a plurality of leadership. Is that pretty evident here from this? Okay, let's look at a few other places. Just turn back previous author, back to 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 2. Starting with verse 1, the elders, plural among you, I exhort, I who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ and also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed. Shepherd, okay, that's an imperative. In English, when we have imperatives, we don't put the word you. Now, sometimes we do, and we say, you get over here. I mean, we do that, and we're adding a little bit more emphasis. Well, the fact of the matter is, even though we don't put the word you in there, it's part of it. It just is English leaves it out. But we understand that it's a you. But the you here is plural. Addressed to the elders. Notice verse 1, the elders, plural, among you. So it's you, plural, shepherd, how many flocks? One. Of God that is among you. Now, let's pretend for a moment. Let's pretend that he's talking about the universal church when he talks about the flock of God. Well, then we would have a way of saying that there are different elders over, you know, one elder over this church, another elder over that church, another elder over that church. But how can we say that that flock is among them? That doesn't fit real well. Do you see the difficulty there? Rather, what he's pointing at is to a local congregation and saying, shepherd the one flock that is among you, plural elders. Plurality of elders is the easiest way to approach this passage. But let's look back at Acts chapter 14, 23. And this one is really a very, very, very strong passage. It's harder to get around than the passage in 1 Peter 5, 2. Now, Acts chapters 13 and 14 are the first missionary journey of Paul. And what we have is Paul went through a series of cities and then he had to backtrack out. Diane was talking about going up Silverado Canyon, or Silverado. Well, you know, there's one thing if you are going by car up Silverado Canyon. You go in one way and you don't drive out the other way, right? You go in one way and you come back out the same way. This is what happened in the first missionary journey. Paul went in, they planted churches, and then they came back out and traced their way back to get to the coast. And so in verse 23, it's after they're on their return trip. How do we know that? Verse 21, and when they had preached the gospel to that city in Derbe and made disciples, they returned to Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch, strengthening the souls of the disciples, and so on and so forth. So when they had appointed elders in every church. Now for the length of time that they were in all of these cities as they went in and then backtracked out, they weren't planting five churches in each city. They plant one congregation in this city, plant a congregation in the next city, plant a congregation in the next city. Then they come back through and visit those congregations that they had planted. And notice, they appointed elders, plural, in every church. Plurality of elders is very clearly seen here. Let's look at Acts chapter 20. Verse 17, I cite because it tells us that he's talking to elders from Miletus, the city of Miletus, which is a port city. He sent to Ephesus and called for the elders of the church, that is, the elders of the church at Ephesus. A lot of people want to say, well, okay, there were a whole bunch of churches in Ephesus. Okay, a whole bunch of houses, and each of these houses had a separate congregation. Okay, well, let's assume that for the moment, and let's see what happens in verse 28. He's talking to those elders. Therefore, take heed to yourselves, plural, and to all the flock among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers to shepherd the church of God. Now notice, local church congregation that's being spoken of that has a plurality of elders. Let's turn to page 4 of the notes. And here we'll look at 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 17. Just as a footnote, Grace Chapel has always had a plurality of elders as part of its constitution. That's been with Grace Chapel ever since its beginning. But 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 17. Let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of a double honorarium, especially those who labor in the word and teaching. Now, what I'm going to want to do here is the easy part. let's figure out who especially should get a double honorarium, and let's figure out those for whom it's guaranteed that they don't need it, as far as Paul's concerned. What two things would the person need to do in order to especially get the double honorarium? Rule well, and labor in the word and doctrine. Okay, so notice in that chart, I have a 1 by the people who labor in the word and teaching and who rule well. I have that 1 grayed out, and then notice who is it that Paul would never in a million years say that they ought to get a double honorarium. It's the ones who don't rule well and don't labor in the word and teaching. So we've got those 2 boxes grayed out. See that? So pretend that they're not even there. Now what we're going to wrestle with is who should be number 2 and who should be number 3. And it might seem backwards, what Paul did. It might seem backwards. Who would you think would be number 2? Well, lo and behold, it's the ones who don't labor in the word and teaching, but rule well. Now, does that seem a little backwards? Yeah, it does. Does that seem really odd that Paul would say it's more important for an elder to rule well than it is for him to labor in the word and teaching? I mean, if he's going to get an honorarium, if he's going to get any pay, by golly, he had better rule well. Don't have to worry about whether he labors in the word and doctrine. Now, does that really seem backwards? But that's what he says, isn't it? Well, let's just assume for a moment that Paul was thinking of a church that had, that all churches only have 1 elder. Let's assume that that's what Paul's thinking. Then what you really need to do is make sure that the pastor, the teaching elder, is really good at ruling. And you make sure he gets a big salary because he rules. But he doesn't know anything about the word. He can't teach. Can you imagine what that church would be like? That's true. Now, does that sound like something that Paul would be recommending? I don't think so. Now, on the other hand, imagine that Paul is thinking of congregations having more than 1 elder. Well, do you see Frank, Ricardo, and me getting into a fist fight every time that it comes to church service to figure out who's going to get up in the pulpit and who's going to speak? We've already reached that. We've got a schedule. We know how that's going to be laid out. Frank and Ricardo have their areas of responsibility that are areas that are not my responsibility. We all are involved in ruling, but each one of us has particular aspects of the ruling that we focus upon. But then there's 1 elder who spends a little more time in the teaching situation. Ricardo does speak from the pulpit. Frank does speak from the pulpit. Sometimes we have other people speak from the pulpit. But under a model where there's more than 1 elder, what Paul would be saying is, well, honoraria would be figured out on the basis that the elders need to be involved in ruling. They need to be making sure that the congregation is functioning well, but does that mean that there need to be 3 elders standing up here talking simultaneously each church service? As they would look at giving some support to each of the elders, they had a need for more elders for ruling than they did for teaching. Does that make sense? It's kind of like we find it as well. There's need for more people to be doing administrative types of ruling issues than the number that are needed for actually speaking. On a consistent basis, there's a need for a larger number of those that are involved in ruling. That is why Paul is able to say that ruling is the criterion for finding out if an elder is worthy of the double honorarium, not teaching. Now, notice how that's backwards from how most churches set things up. Most churches are focused upon what happens in the pulpit as the sole criteria for the remuneration that occurs. Paul is saying that there's something else at work, and that something else at work is to make sure that the elders are involved in all aspects of ruling to make sure that the congregation, the church, functions as it's supposed to function. Sometimes individuals will have difficulties that come up in their life, and they may be more comfortable talking with one elder or another elder and that about their particular difficulty that they've encountered. There's a need for more than one elder in order that the needs of the congregation can be met. All of the passages that we're looking at that we have seen about this issue are going in a different direction than modern Christianity tends to go with church leadership. But it's not that you have a bunch of elders, but you have one who's way up there, and he's the powerhouse, because that was the problem that was happening with the Diotrephes. Each of the elders has an equal position. When it comes to decisions being made, each has input, and it isn't that one elder can outvote all the others. So we're trying to give a little bit of a clue as to why it is that Grace Chapel functions the way that it does. We believe that we're operating according to the best approach from what the text says for us. Now, I'm going to add a little footnote at the bottom of the page. Sometimes a person might raise an objection to this because they say that 1 Timothy 3:2 says that elders are supposed to be able to teach. Well, all the elders here are able to teach. They all have that capability, but what people will often get out of this, and now the word bishop we've seen before is equivalent to an elder in 1 Timothy 3:2. Able to teach does not require that the person have the spiritual gift of teacher. That is not a prerequisite. The word that's translated able to teach is a single word. It's didaktikos. It's a verbal adjective. Now, it has a passive sense. I mean, it has an active sense, excuse me. But let me give it an equivalent with a passive sense. We have the English word teachable. Teachable means able to be taught. If we were to reword this, it would be teachingable. Now, that's not an English word, but you get the idea. That would be really a better way of communicating the idea here, in the sense that it doesn't lead us to think, oh, this person has to have the gift of teacher. That's not prerequisite. We have other passages where this word is used, this concept is used. For example, older women are to teach younger women how to love their husbands and so forth. It doesn't require that they have the spiritual gift of teacher. Parents are supposed to teach their children. Does it require that someone have a spiritual gift of teacher to be able to teach their children? That's not required for being an elder. But what's happened is people often assume, well, there's only one elder, and he's the man in the pulpit, and he needs to have a teacher gift. But when we look at it from the standpoint, all elders are supposed to be teachingable. It doesn't mean that all elders need to have the teaching gift. For example, Frank has the gift of evangelist. It doesn't require for him to be a teacher, have the teaching spiritual gift to be teachable, to be able to communicate what it is that he does, to be able to equip the saints in that area. Throughout the New Testament, what we see is an emphasis upon plurality of leadership. There needs to be a check and balance. I think there's an obvious need for check and balance because each one of us has a sin nature. And there needs to be a balance. And that's, when we look at the New Testament carefully, it goes in the direction of multiple leadership. It also helps to guard against putting the interests of oneself ahead of the interests of the whole group. When we look at what the New Testament is driving us towards, it's driving us towards Christ-likeness, which has much to do with us being able to put aside our own self-interests at times when it's better for the group, for us not to be pushing ahead with what we want. And so as we look at the book of 3 John, which we've considered this Wednesday and the previous Wednesday, Gaius was a man who stood for truth. As strangers and as people that he knew came through, he was very hospitable and he took pains to make sure that they would be able to conduct their ministry. And he did so at great sacrifice because he needed to do so in the face of having someone like Diotrephes there. And John doesn't want Gaius to cave in. He wants him to continue to do that which he has been doing. And John urges him to do so and announces that he plans to see him shortly. He had much that he wanted to write to him, but he'd rather speak to him in person. This has got to be our shortest series that we've ever had. We have a couple other short books in the New Testament. We might have a couple more short series.